it's an interesting adventure traveling with one's children, and at various times my children have seen the world. And maybe my daughter Deborah will come in here later on. She's the absolutely gorgeous 8-year-old. Traveling with one's children makes for incredible joy. She's shy, that's also okay. We're talking about conversion today, and I'm going to deal with three different issues. The first issue is a historical one, the second a halachic one, and the third, the world that we live in now. Historically, at least for the last 1,500 years, conversion has been rare. We don't really know the exact conversion rates, but, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik said to us once in Shir that when he was a little boy growing up, they used to go Erev Shavuos to visit the grave of the convert in Vilna. The convert. He converted to Judaism, the Rav said to us, by tradition in 1759, Erev Shavuot, and Motzei Shavuot, they murdered him. This is what the Rav told us. And they murdered him. The Catholics, they murdered him. And so they used to visit the grave of the Ger Tzedek of Vilna. There was one. One in the last 200 years, give or take. And that was conversion. The Catholic community and the Muslim community that we've had two experiences with were hostile to conversion. People didn't really convert to Judaism. As I said last night, I remarked that many years ago I was privileged to see the Vilna Dayanus book from 1837 to 1940, 103-year period, and I remarked on how few the number of divorces were. There were 37 divorces in that 103-year period. How many conversions? None. That's the right number. Zero. Not a single conversion in Vilna. Vilna had more than 1 million Jews. Not a single conversion to Judaism from 1837 to 1940. In 1938, there were two converts in the makings because Vilna had liberalized and there were people pending conversion, but after the German invasion, that just didn't seem like a good idea, to put it mildly. So the first is a historical comment, which is the halachot of conversion, while not quite dormant, were relatively infrequent in the Jewish tradition. People didn't want to be Jewish. And only sincere, theologically motivated people converted to Judaism. It was exceptionally rare. You just have to understand that that's the reality. So the notion that in the year 1125, in the middle of the Crusades, a nice Christian boy would meet a nice Jewish girl and convert to Judaism, like, that was ridiculous. So these things didn't happen. It's not until the liberalization of Christian morals and the general religious freedom that we so comfortably experience in the United States and Canada that conversion becomes something that people contemplate. And indeed, if we look back on one of the unique features of American, and when I say American, I mean Canadian. You're not culturally distinct, I sense, from the United States here. Okay. But nonetheless, if I look at the trends within Orthodoxy in Toronto, the trends within Orthodoxy in Toronto are much closer to the trends within Orthodoxy in the United States than, for example, what I saw when I was sent to Tehran. You're much closer to New York culturally than Tehran Jewry is. I think so. What you see in the United States, and I'll just give you an interesting observation. How many of you know firsthand a Jew who's apostatized out of Judaism? Come on, raise your hand. How many of you know firsthand somebody who's apostatized out of Judaism? I know one. Anybody else? Who was born a Jew who converted to Christianity? Shmad. No, apostatized out. How many of you know a Jew who converted out of Judaism? How many of you know somebody who converted into Judaism? Okay? So do you see that that balance is uniquely America? In Judaism, 200 years ago, everybody knew people who converted out of Judaism under pressure, and nobody knew anybody who was a convert. As again, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, they used to visit, the Jews in Vilna used to go visit the grave of the convert. They didn't know him, he had died 200 years ago, but they knew there was a grave of a convert. Here in America, nobody knows anybody who's left Judaism. All of us know somebody who's converted into Judaism. Not only that, how many of you know more than three converts? Okay, do you see conversion into Judaism is common? Judaism is, this is an incredible historical change. This is an incredible historical change. The halachot of conversion are only now starting to deal with this reality. People are banging down the doors to become Jewish, and nobody is banging down the doors to leave. Of course, you're right. It's not that they don't exist, but if you all the studies show the number of people who are seeking to convert into Judaism is far larger than the number of people who are seeking to leave. This is in contrast with the general social sense, which is about 15% of the Jewish community apostatized out in Eastern Europe over the course of their lifetime.
Jews for Jesus?
It's very small. You're right, it does exist, but it's relatively small. If you compare the numbers in to the numbers out, you see this. That doesn't mean it never exists, but it's relatively rare. Please. But we're not. Right?
You meet all these kids now, and none of their children are, most of their children are not being raised.
You're 100% correct, but even in. Like, I'm a law professor, not at a Jewish law school, at a Methodist law school. Nonetheless, the number of people who feel social pressure to apostatize out is very, very small. The social pressure to apostatize out 100 years ago in Europe was large. The social pressure to apostatize out, nobody ever turns to you and says, you know, you could get this job if only you were a Christian. Doesn't happen anymore. It just doesn't happen anymore that people are told, of course you can succeed, but you can't succeed unless you're a Unitarian. It just that conversation is more or less over. So what's happening in conversion is we're living in an open society, and people comfortably accept and recognize that we're Jews and peers, and thus the notion of becoming Jewish no longer is subject to sort of this danger or the sense that becoming Jewish was a preposterous proposition. Thus, we have large numbers of conversions. In response to this, historically, within the United States, conversions were always done by individual rabbis. Since conversion was a relatively new matter, starting around 1945, when conversions became more common, conversions were something that local shul rabbis did. And they did so by forming an ad hoc Besdin and welcoming people into their community as converts, according to their own standards. This ad hoc conversion process has always been fraught with difficulty. The reason why it's been fraught with structure difficulty is because every local rabbi had his own standards and his own pressures and his own difficulties, and he formed his own standards for conversions based on that reality. Just like for years and years in the beginning of Jewry in the United States, Kashrut was local, but it didn't work because every rabbi formed his own standards, and it produced a mishmash of kosher standards and a certain amount of fraud. And it wasn't until kosher started to be centralized that it began to work in the sense of develop a coherent product, persuade people it was authentic and legitimate. The same thing is going on now with regards to conversion. And people are looking at it and saying, wow, this is a sea change. And it is some sort of a sea change, but the sea change is, at its core, a good one. What's happening in the United States and in Canada is that for the past 30 years, every rabbi made his own decisions as to when to convert, and some of these decisions were bad, but they weren't subject to any sort of peer review. Sometimes rabbis made bad decisions because they themselves had bad judgment. It's not impossible. Sometimes these rabbis made bad decisions because they were subject to congregational pressure. People would go to the rabbi and say, my daughter is marrying this fellow on this date. He better be converted by this date. And rabbis, precisely because they earned their living from their shuls, became subject to political pressure by their members. Meaning, when you create a construct in which you invest judicial authority in your employee, it turns out that people will go up to this employee and say, if you don't do this my way, I'll vote against your contract. Either they would say this straight out, or they would say it subtly. And rabbis sensed and felt that conversion wasn't working because they were subject to way too much local pressure. In addition, and we have to talk about this candidly, there's a certain number of rotten apples in every business, and there were rabbis who were selling conversions, who were doing conversions simply knowingly, improperly, because it was lucrative to do so. Because it was lucrative to do so, meaning in every profession, and in the rabbinate as well, there are certain people who sell. That's very sad, but it's true. The way this was dealt with in Kashrut was centralization. So there's a very fine book that's worth reading called Holiness and Fraud, dealing with Kashrus in the United States in the 20s and 30s. And it explains how in the 20s and 30s, when there were about 2 million Jews in New York City who kept kosher, a huge number, Kashrus was in total disarray, and there was an enormous amount of fraud from nefarious rabbis who would certify things as kosher that certainly weren't. Or there was, as the economics professors call it, a race to the bottom, who could have the lowest authentic standards. Okay, that's just the way it is. Who could have the lowest yet authentic standards? And it produced some people with low standards that were inauthentic. This is what has happened with conversion. The Orthodox rabbinate as a whole in the last 25 years has struggled to deal with the influx of conversions. And I see myself sitting as a dayan in a Beis Din routinely answering questions about conversions, that the conversion policies throughout the United States and Canada were grossly inconsistent. What you expected of a convert varied from community to community. What the conversion process was differed from community to community. The fees charged differed from community to community. And even the core authenticity of the product differed from community to community. And part of the job of the Beis Din of America was to tell people, we think this conversion is proper, and we think this conversion is not proper. And this became a huge mess. And the reason why it became a mess is because these very diverse standards proved impossible to live with in the real world. And the Israeli rabbinate looked at America and certainly didn't understand it. Because in Israel, things were centralized. So there were 5, 6, 7 Batei Din for conversion. And in the United States, there were 25,000, meaning every rabbi and his two friends would form a Beit Din for conversion. And you couldn't keep track of who was who, and what was what, and what was worthwhile, and what wasn't. And you couldn't even keep track of who was a fraud, by the way. And there was a market, even occasionally, in fraudulent conversion certificates. Because if any synagogue rabbi could convert anybody, then all I really need to do to market fraudulent conversion certificates is get a good piece of synagogue stationery and market conversion certificates. So about a decade ago, the Beis Din of America reached this internal consensus that we were going to start trying to regulate the conversion process. And this started in 1994 with the Ishur process, which is, we said in 1994 that every RCA member who does conversions, who wishes to have his conversions recognized, has to submit to a process by the Beis Din of America in which we validate conversions. You don't have to submit to the process, but if you don't submit to the process, we don't assume your conversions are valid. And some rabbis said, well, we're not going to submit. So they didn't submit. Most rabbis submitted to the process, and that was fine as well. And by the way, even within the RCA, there are very diverse conversion standards. There are RCA rabbis who don't, in fact, require that you accept mitzvot as valid. There are RCA rabbis who, in fact, require that you accept mitzvot as valid, but not personally be observant. That's just the truth. There's no getting around that fact. And these views have a basis in halacha even. Without discussing here and now the exact basis, there is a basis in halacha for this view. But what happens is, as I said before, is you have the fall to the bottom for the lowest authentic standards. And in our desire to prevent that from happening, we established a process of Ishur, of validation. Ishur literally means validation for conversion, so that if you are an RCA member, you would submit your conversions for validation. We would investigate your standards, and if you met what we thought were the consensus standards that we wanted, we would write a letter saying this conversion was valid, this conversion was valid, this conversion was valid. And that process ran for about a decade. Longer than a decade, 12 years. In 2006, the RCA began moving for a different process, which is a more centralized process. I'm sorry.
Sorry, was that the same for Reform and Orthodox, the RCA?
No, the RCA is the Rabbinical Council of America. It's Orthodox. I'm sorry? It's a mix. Both. If you look around in Toronto, you'll see a mix of RCA rabbis. It certainly has very few Hasidic rabbis. I would say that. They began pushing for something that we now call the GPS, the Geirus system. And it takes it one step further. It argues that communities should form local Batei Din, and only that Beit Din should do conversions, and conversions should be removed from the hands of local synagogue rabbis, and instead should be delegated like Kashrut and like Gittin to a Beit Din that's more distant from the matter, with the hopes that by being more distant from the matter, they'll be able to preserve standards better and eliminate a certain amount of trickery or nefariousness or deviating from standards, which we think is almost inevitable when a synagogue rabbi has to convert somebody who's in fact related to or himself a dues-paying member. So this system was put in place about 2 years ago. It's slowly growing and expanding. There are a number of regional Batei Din now in the United States. I think there are 10. and I think there are going to be three more before the year 2008 gets out. And the purpose of this process is to do two things. It's to create uniform standards and to prevent fraud. And the regional Batei Din, in essence, adopt the following standard. They adopt the view that in order to convert somebody into Judaism, these regional Batei Din will ensure that the convert is, in fact, Orthodox in practice, realizing that that standard means different things in different places, but nonetheless, the basic standard will be that the congregants will be Orthodox in practice. Fees will be reasonably controlled, so in most of the GPS-based Batei Din, the fee for conversion is $500. There are rabbis in Brooklyn. There was just a court case involving a husband and wife who got divorced one of the issues in the divorce was decided by the judge was whether the fee paid for the conversion should be deducted from his set of marital assets or her set of marital assets, because she was not Jewish and she argued that the conversion was really done for his benefit, so it should count for him. Now, you want to say how much was the conversion? Don't you want to know the answer? $30,000. Okay? So I know when you have a conversion that costs $30,000, you know what it is? It's bought. It's bought. That's what it is. It's bought. So, of course, it's very distressing. It's very, very distressing that should be the case. But it is. Nonetheless, it is. That's just the reality. It just is. The only way you can regulate this is by taking these things out of the hands of local rabbis and putting them in the hands of a more structured organization. And so the Geirus network that the RCA is establishing serves the goal of articulating a standard and enforcing the standard and taking this away from the local rabbis, who either sometimes will not obey the standard or sometimes will engage in conduct that's inconsistent with the standard, and move Geirus to the next step, which is part of the more centralized Orthodox rabbinate. From my perspective, and I guess I'm one of the players in this because I'm one of the members of the Beis Din of America, there's no reason why there shouldn't be other such networks with different standards. There's no reason to assume that the standards that the RCA has put forward are the only authentic standards. I could imagine standards to the right of us and standards to the left of us. But what I think is a very positive thing is the notion that conversions shouldn't be done by the rabbi, who's in fact intimately involved with the lives of the people that he's converting, is an exceptionally good idea. Rabbis are, at their core in the United States, shul employees. And because they're shul employees, they have a hard time saying no to their congregants. And they're continuously suffered to buffeting currents that pressure them in one way or another. And that's just simply not a good process for a judicial activity like conversion. Just like we wouldn't like to have a shul rabbi certify the kashrut of a member's bakery, because he'd be continuously subject to pressure, which is, if you revoke my kashrut certificate, I will seek to revoke your rabbi certificate. I'm sorry?
On the bakery, I don't swallow it.
Okay, but I think that's why in the United States, and in Canada, we've moved away from local hashgachas. Individual rabbis rarely give hashgachas, and we look down on them, exactly because we understand that when an individual rabbi gives a hashgacha, you only have to bribe one person, or beat up one person, or persuade one person to change their mind in order to get a bad result. Whereas when you create a centralized team effort, it doesn't mean it works perfectly, because of course, sometimes it doesn't work perfectly. Sometimes the whole team makes a mistake, or sometimes the whole team is coerced, or the whole team is bribed. But the more people and the more centralized the process is, the better off you are. And by the way, this is true for Bate Din generally. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. And I have this one firm rule about Dine Torah, which is I don't hear Dine Torah in Atlanta. I hear Dine Torah almost everywhere. I've traveled to, you name it, Orthodox Jewish population from, you know, Melbourne to Tehran. I've been there. But I don't hear Dine Torah in Atlanta, because in Atlanta, the Orthodox Jewish population is made up of three groups, in my little mind. It's made up of my congregants, okay? Then it's made up of people who aren't my congregants, who I want to be my congregants. And then it's made up of people who aren't my congregants, thank God. It's very hard. It's very hard to be impartial in that environment where you know everybody and everybody knows you. And this creates very serious problems, and it creates very serious problems in conversion as well. And there's just no getting around the fact that if we're going to run a successful conversion process that in fact converts people to Judaism with authenticity, it's because we're going to create a process in which the people who are involved in the conversion process are somewhat distant from the convert themselves and capable of looking down with a modicum of neutral judgment. So the details of the GPS process, I'm glad to talk to you about. Some of them I agree with, some of them I don't agree with. But the notion, and they're evolving themselves, who knows you know, what little changes will take place over time. But the basic notion, which is that if we're going to react to the reality around us, which is conversion is very common, and people are banging on our doors to come in, and we want to preserve authentic, real standards, we won't be able to do that if the person who is the gatekeeper of the authentic, real standards is the synagogue rabbi who has to interact with this couple before, during, and after the conversion, and who earns a livelihood from their fees, and who is otherwise very closely connected to them. So I look at this change at its core in a very positive way, not 100%, but if the standard for making change is we only make change when it's 100% positive, so then no change will ever take place. This is a step in the right direction. There are other steps, but this is a step in the right direction.
This is understandable based on an individual. In Israel, there's a whole different problem where you have a large amount of population. A national issue. Work, you know, is that to be taken into account, and how long the decision is different?
So this is what we spoke about last night. You have to decide whether you like centralized religious authority that's coercive. And if you like centralized religious authority that's coercive, then you have to be prepared to like it when it coerces you, and not just when it coerces the other guy. We have a tendency to like centralized religious authority only when we control it. Meaning it's nice to be the Pope. It's just not fun to be Catholic. So I think that you raised the right issue. This is what we spoke about more or less last night. I think Israel is more complex. I think that we have very ambivalent attitudes towards centralized religious authority. But if you want a single accepted solution, you'll only get it through centralized religious authority.
Yeah, but there's two opposed, like what I'm not from Rabinowitz, I was told. And someone checked it out with his grandson. I don't know if it's true, but he said we should have a mass conversion.
But I can't, meaning there are a dozen possible answers how to handle this, none of which are consensus-driven. They're all individual-driven. You'll never achieve consensus. It's hard to herd cats. I was criticized last night for a cat metaphor, so I'll use another one. It's just hard to herd cats. Orthodox Judaism is autonomous and non-hierarchical. And the notion that we'll reach a solution that everybody agrees to is just very difficult. I can't imagine that. We don't have a single kosher standard. We don't have a single marriage standard. Why should we have a single conversion standard?
Could you
could you speak about, I understand the centralized concept and I think it does work, but could you speak about situations where it might not work, where, for example, there may be local issues, where, for example, knowledge of a more direct, intimate knowledge of the situation is an advantage. And I'll give you an example, a real example of a small town, working class suburb north of a city in the United States where the population was dwindling. There was one shul, one rabbi. The kosher butcher was going out of business, could not afford to pay for hechsher. The rabbi decided to do it for free and was basically kind of run out of town by the bad in the centralized city. So here you have a situation where I think the local may trump the central or the larger.
So I'm always very worried. I won't eat in a butcher shop that has an individual hashgacha. Because for all I know, the rabbi is inept or in cahoot. So, of course, I can imagine situations where that works, but this rabbi might be subject to so much congregational pressure that he's prepared to cut corners. Because exactly what you've described forces this one rabbi who's employed and earning a living to continuously say to himself, you know, if the butcher shop closes, my congregants will leave, I'll be fired. Maybe I should cut a corner. Very scary to me. So my inclination is that even your case that you've described is very difficult. At the end of the day, you've described a situation that's a prime remedy for corner cutting. A rabbi under a great deal of economic duress from the community that's teetering to provide a cheap, free service. I worry.
Hi. I would like to follow up that example, because the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the U.S. was just shut down for playing fun games with these folks.
Sure, but not a kosher violation.
No. True.
So I don't understand. To me, you're going to head down a path that I think is just irrelevant. The OU wasn't certifying.
The OU is immune from the pressure of its largest client.
Right.
Looking at it and saying, we play all kinds of games, but you can't do anything about it.
I think you're completely, totally mistaken. I think the OU's job is to certify the kosherness of the meat, and nothing more and nothing less. I find the OU's conduct in agriprocessors to be proper, not improper at all. Let the secular government regulate these kinds of things. The OU did its job well. So I don't accept the criticism at all in any way, shape, or form. It's not the job of the OU to regulate child labor or union violations or immigration violations. That's the job of the secular government. The OU, in my view, got this 100% right, and they should be applauded.
Do they have a responsibility after the civil government finds them guilty?
The first question is that is not the system of courts that you're not setting up what they've been subject to the approval of the chief rabbi of Israel? And would that then mean to include the possibility of retroactive cancellation of guilt?
So
that's question one.
Okay.
Question two, in terms of the Israeli situation, which you spoke about last night, it's radically different than the American one because the Dayanim in Israel are instruments of the Israeli political system.
Yes, that's
so. Therefore, when you bring in all these Russians under the law of return, and you have a Dayan then saying to them, but you're not Jewish, and not only you're not Jewish, but you think your children are Jewish, surprise. That's an interactive question between North America and Israel.
So the Dayanim and the GPS are approved by the Beis Din of America. They're approved by Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Schwartz and by nobody else. We would not, in fact, approve people that the chief rabbinate disapproves of, and that's a fine policy as well. As far as I know, we've never had anybody who we've wanted to approve of have an issue, and I think that it's a fine system. In terms of the difference between Israel and America, so you're right, Israel's a different situation. Not sure exactly how to deal with the Israeli situation. The law of return never limited people who came to Israel to be people who are Jewish. It never did. So to then turn around and say anybody we admitted in the country we really ought to convert is very complex. I don't have an answer. I have a hard enough time figuring out how to run America and Canada coherently. And you talk about trying to run Israel coherently, so I'll leave that for other people. If we can get things right here, that would be pretty good. Now, a retroactive annulment. There is no provision in Jewish law for retroactive annulment of conversion. Period. Everybody agrees to this. What you can say is that this conversion was never valid. A valid conversion done, if it's valid at the moment of its doing, it's valid in perpetuity. But a conversion that was never valid at the time of its doing is never valid. No different than if I have a piece of meat with an OU on it that I assume is kosher, but it turns out that it isn't, that it never was. So there's no retroactive annulment of conversion imagined in Jewish law. It can't be done. It's not provided for in the codes, as they say. But what you can do is you can say this conversion was never valid. Sometimes that happens. Some conversions never are valid. Okay? So I happen not to agree with Rabbi Sherman's basic approach, but I've encountered conversions done by rabbis who I think are ineligible to serve as rabbis, and all of their conversions are invalid.
Okay, we'll have two questions and then maybe go back to your talk.
Okay. Sure.
You discussed the uniform standards and the standards of future observance of the convert. How do you deal with the issue of adoption by not necessarily observant or sufficiently observant parents, both born Jewish, adopting and don't want to impose on the child that they're adopting the possibility down the line they won't be able to make, so they want a proper Orthodox conversion? How do you deal with that issue?
Okay. I'm going to, when I return to what I'm going to talk about, we're going to talk about the substantive standards of conversion, and that'll be the final conversation. So that's a great question. You'll hold it in abeyance. If I don't answer it by the end, you'll raise your hand and scream out, you didn't answer my question.
Yeah, question regarding individual conversion versus based in or five. How do you get around the issue of, when you have a bod or a based in, you have to call a day by lowest common denominator, you're going to go to the guy who's the most machmir on the based in.
So we have.
Otherwise, you're never going to have an agreement.
So the way it works is we have articulated standards for conversion. They're published, they're on the internet, they're widely available. These are the standards that we, the Beis Din of America, believe are proper. And rabbis who don't agree with them, who want more or less standards, don't affiliate with us. We're not a believer in religious coercion, only in Israel. In America, there's religious freedom. Rabbis who don't agree with our standards should affiliate elsewhere, to the left of us and to the right of us. We have our standards. They're published. They're not secretive. They're in English. They're readily available. We believe in these standards. Rabbis who agree with these standards will coalesce around us. Rabbis who believe in higher standards will coalesce around another organization. Rabbis who believe in lower standards will coalesce around the lower standards. And religious diversity, even within the Orthodox community, is a wonderful good thing. It's good. By the way, Kashrus has not coalesced around the highest standard. Kashrus has not coalesced around the highest standard. Look at the commonness of Stam Chalav. The OU has made very firm stands for lower standards that are accessible. And that's been its source of success. There are higher standards to the right of it, but you don't see it all. The OU standard is not the strictest standard. It's the consensus standard. I suspect conversion will turn out to be just like Kashrus. It will coalesce around a consensus standard and not around the highest standard. I don't think so. Okay. So we'll return to the substantive question of what ought to be the standards. There are, in fact, four views among Rishonim and among contemporary Achronim as to what should be the standards for the conversion of an adult. We'll start with the strictest. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and the Chazon Ish are of the view that in order to convert to Judaism, a person needs both a theological Kabbalat mitzvot and a practical Shmirat mitzvot. And that unless a person both theologically accepts that mitzvot are binding and Jews are the Am HaNivchar, and they in fact observe that standard, their conversion is invalid. Of course, that doesn't mean that you have to be a saint to be a convert. Now, Rabbi Lam has this wonderful, famous story about the woman who was converting to Judaism. She's worked on it for a year. She's now standing in the mikveh up to her neck. She turns to Rabbi Lam and says, "I don't want to convert to Judaism anymore." Rabbi Lam says, "What do you mean you don't want to convert to Judaism anymore?" She says, "Well, I heard you say that gossip is prohibited. And I find when I come to your shul, I'm drawn to gossip. And I've worked hard to not gossip in shul, but I can't stop. I can't stop. And I heard you say that it's not prohibited to gossip if you're not Jewish. So maybe I should stay not Jewish and I won't have a problem then gossiping." Of course, the punchline of the joke was Rabbi Lam's comment that he turned to the woman and said, "Well, if you find yourself drawn to gossip in shul, you were probably born Jewish and didn't even know it." But the take-home halachic message is you don't have to be a saint. All of us occasionally mess up. Even Rabbi Feinstein and the Chazon Ish acknowledge that occasional sin due to temptation doesn't void a conversion, but you have to theologically and practically accept upon yourself an Orthodox lifestyle. Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzynski, who died in Vilna in 1940, articulates a lower standard. He says a person has to fully and completely accept that mitzvot are binding theologically, and he has to strive to observe them. But in fact, so long as a person observes the highlights of mitzvot, even if in fact his conduct is not what we would consider fully orthodox, it's sufficient. You can convert such a person because he both accepts that he should keep, and he in fact strives to keep. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, the Melamed Lehoyel, and the Beis Yitzchok, Rabbi Yitzchok Schmelz, articulate an even lower standard. They accept that a person has to accept that mitzvot are binding, but even if they're living a life where their theology and their practice are not consistent, such a person can be converted to Judaism because they sincerely want to observe, even if in fact they're not observant at all. Rabbi Hoffman permits the conversion of, for example, a non-Jewish woman who's already civilly married to a man who's a Kohen and is going to live her whole life in a prohibited marriage. He says that's permissible, and the Beis Yitzchok says the same thing in a slightly different case. And the fourth view is the view of Rabbi Unterman and Rabbi Gorin, which is that conversion can take place even without Kabbalat mitzvot, so long as the person wishes to join Am Yisrael, even if in fact the person doesn't accept as binding that they have to observe mitzvot, that conversion can take place validly anyway. Those four standards all are what I would call authentic. Authentic doesn't mean right. It means said by authentic pronouncers of Judaism. In terms of conversion of minors, I promised you, there are three different views. Here, Rabbi Feinstein takes the most lenient view. Rabbi Feinstein says, anybody who's a child can be converted to Judaism, even if they're not going to be observant at all, since it's an unmitigated benefit to be a Jew when you're not bound by Jewish law. And when is it an unmitigated benefit to be a Jew when you're not bound by Jewish law? When you're a child. And thus, he permits the wholesale conversion of minor children. The second view is the view taken by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. He says children can only be converted to Judaism when there's a reasonable belief that they'll get a Jewish education So they could choose to be religious. And the third view is, no, children should only be converted to Judaism when in fact it appears reasonable, probable that they themselves are going to grow up to be religious. So here we have four standards for what makes a proper conversion for adults and three standards for what makes a proper conversion for a child. On a practical level, orthodoxy has coalesced around a standard somewhere above Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzinski's and maybe a little bit below Rabbi Feinstein's standard for adults. And we don't convert adults unless they are, in fact, orthodox or nearly so. And that's been the standard, that's been the norm, consensus standard in the United States for many, many, many years. And that's the standard that the RCA Gayrus Network articulates for adults. And you should know, I'll say this to you candidly, anybody who has a conversion in which they themselves, in which the convert is not, in fact, observant of Jewish law at the time of their conversion, they should know that their conversion will be questioned. And it doesn't matter who signs the certificate and who validates the certificate. If, in fact, you're not observant at the time of your conversion will be questioned. And the reason why it will be questioned is because giants of Jewish law maintain that such a conversion wasn't valid. And it doesn't matter who tells you they think your conversion is valid. Others will tell you that the conversion is not valid. And the reason why this is so is because conversion requires acceptance of mitzvot. And how to define acceptance of mitzvot is a dispute. So we, in fact, in the Gayrus Network, in the RCA Gayrus Network, we default to the standard of de facto orthodoxy without knowing exactly how to define it, because it does vary a little bit from community to community. We know what orthodoxy looks like when we see it. We know the difference between people who orthodox affiliate in their synagogue but aren't orthodox in their life. And so we, in fact, only do conversions for people who are, in fact, themselves shomer mitzvot, observant. You want to press on the details, so you can always press on the details. But the details are relatively unimportant as compared to the overarching standard, which is we require de facto orthodoxy. In terms of the conversion of a minor child, this matter is still a little bit in flux. The guidelines as they're now written do not require that the child or his parents be orthodox. In fact, they're inclined to require a day school education and nothing more, which is the middle standard here. I could imagine them going higher, and I even could imagine them going lower. And so this is a complicated conversation. I'm not 100% sure where the outcome will in fact be. But I think when it comes to the conversion of adults, orthodoxy in America has coalesced around the notion that in order for a person to be successfully converted to Judaism, they have to in fact be orthodox. What will this mean in fact? I'm sure it'll mean to some extent a narrowing of the base of orthodox converts. But this reflects perhaps a more general sense we have within orthodoxy, and maybe this will be the final thought for today before we take more questions. Maybe orthodoxy is better served by having a narrower base of people who actually live an orthodox life than returning to the models of the 50s, where many, many, many people affiliated with orthodoxy and were comfortable talking the talk but never bothered to walk the walk. And we saw, looking back in the 50s, how weak orthodoxy was and how quickly the children deserted it because all they saw in their parents was hypocrisy. And that's not a good way to raise your children. 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, Edgar Bronfman was interviewed. I don't really know the man at all, but I gather he's Canadian. When he was asked about how observant he was, he said something incredible. He said, "We identified with a synagogue. My father went to work on Saturdays. He expected me to go to synagogue to hell with that. That's what he said. Meaning, it turns out that if you want to raise children Orthodox and build a firm, strong Orthodox community, it's because you require of the adults that they, in fact, be Shomer Mitzvot. And this is a narrowing of the base of Orthodoxy away from its model of the 50s, where you had huge Orthodox synagogues made up of people who weren't at all observant, but who somehow identified as Orthodox by their synagogue selection. Even though Orthodoxy looked very powerful then, it was, we all know, a castle built on sand. Because the real measure of the power of a movement isn't the size of the edifice, but it's the religious fervor of the congregants. So we're looking to build religiously fervent congregants and religiously fervent converts, and not necessarily going for the largest number of people or to fill our pews with people who have no sense of what we're doing or why we're doing it, so long as they come and pay dues. Very hard conversation. All of you have witnessed that transformation in Orthodoxy, and almost all of us think we're better off in the year 2008 than we were in 1958, even though by many measures the edifices were bigger in 1958 than they were in 2008. Thank you very much, and we'll take another round of questions. Didn't you ask one already?
No.
He did? Okay, only one per person.
That was funny. Yes, Nicole. I'm going to go to the other question.
Afterwards, we can talk.
I have a question.
Okay, she's in.
I just wanted to ask, we've heard Rabbi Angel speak here.
He's a very nice man.
Yeah. So one of his concerns about a centralized authority is, again, this question of when you define what is a halakhic standard, it depends also, there's such a variation in what's expected. He gave two examples that come to mind. One was someone in the Midwest where the girl had become very, very Orthodox practice and was doing everything but her fiance was called in from Europe and he was conservative. So the conversion was rejected based on the fact that he wasn't as Shomer Mitzvot the same way. The second example he gave was from Israel, where a girl was, again, taking everything on, but at the baking, they said, what are you going to be doing after you burn? I'm going to the army. So that means you'll be wearing pants. Come back after you finish the army. Like, where do you cut the line of what makes you Orthodox? You're covering the head. Questions like this.
So I think in all of these situations, line drawing is hard. And when somebody says, well, what about 1 inch over the line? So if the line is to have any value, it's because you draw it. And so, of course, I think that that's a reasonable question. But I think Rabbi Angel was playing a game with you, because Rabbi Angel believes that you can do conversions without acceptance of mitzvot at all. Okay? And although he might have been critiquing these particular standards, if that's what he said to you, then his observations were disingenuous to their core. Because Rabbi Angel was a follower of Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Gorin, who believes and has written, and I respect, that he thinks conversions should be done by people who identify with the Jewish community, even though they do not believe at all in Torah Misinai. So I don't have a problem when somebody says, well, here's the line, could it be 1 inch over? The answer is sure, but if we move it 1 inch over, somebody will say, could it be another inch over? Anytime you draw a line, at its margins, line drawing is arbitrary. That's the nature of line drawing. But that's not Rabbi Angel's real critique. Rabbi Angel's real critique is that Rabbi Angel believes we should convert people to Judaism who have no interest in living an Orthodox lifestyle. And he relies on the view of Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Gorin. He should be respected for that, even as it's not our halachic standard. No different than a person who wishes to sell his kosher meat that isn't glatt. I would say about such meat, it certainly is kosher, and I wouldn't eat it, and I wouldn't let it be served in my shul, but I wouldn't call it treif. But I wouldn't, in fact, eat it.
Okay, can I ask you, for those of us who didn't sponsor here, can you
I'm not really at my core an expert in life in Israel, so I'll punt on the question of what's going on with Rabbi Druckmann and the rabbinical court, but it has at its core to do with the standards of conversion used in Rabbi Druckmann's court. She's in charge. I'm just a servant.
I asked a question yesterday to Rabbi Brody yesterday. And I don't remember what it was. I wanted to answer from yesterday.
I'm sorry, I don't remember either.
So I have a question. What is the process of a conversion controversy in Israel and beyond?
The process of conversion is acceptance of mitzvot, immersion in a circumcision, and then immersion in a mikvah. And that's the real heart of the conversion process. I don't want to deal with it. It's a digression. If you really want me to, I came here to talk about conversion, not kosher slaughter, but I'm glad to digress if you want.
That's one issue, Rabbi. In the event that someone is found not to be appearing and found guilty of a criminal or civil offense, would OU then be responsible to take that into consideration?
I don't speak for the OU as to what their policies are, but I think a kosher certifying organization certifies kashers. My wife is a labor lawyer for the United States government, and when she encounters illegal immigrants, you know what she says? Not my job. I only enforce the labor laws, not the immigration laws, and I look aside. There's an important lesson on that from a United States attorney.
On a practical point of view, what the OC does in terms of investigating the background of people saying whose late grandmother maybe was a cobbler, or etc., in terms of that person wants to get married and up there. So, what is the secure Moses?
So, when it comes to answering status questions, we answer status questions. We don't conduct sua sponte investigations of people, but when somebody comes to us and says, I want to get married, am I Jewish? We answer that question. We investigate to the best of our ability. We bear an obligation as an authentic interpreter of Jewish law to investigate. So everybody who asks the question gets investigated. I don't know what else to do. We investigate.
If somebody got converted,
if in fact at the time of the person's conversion the person genuinely sincerely intended to accept mitzvot as binding, the conversion is valid and nothing the person does in the future can ever undermine his conversion. So if the conversion is valid when the convert pops out of the mikvah, it's valid, and if the conversion isn't valid unless at that moment, then it isn't valid. There's no such thing as a retroactive annulment of conversions. It's like revocation of smicha. It can't be found. It's not found in the codes.
As I understand it, the RCA in America has subjected itself to the de facto control of the Rabbanut in terms of meeting certain standards.
I don't think that the premise of the question is wrong. These are the standards that we've always wanted have been orthodoxy in fact, and those are the standards that we use. I've never felt any control from the Israeli chief rabbinate in any way, shape, or form. We do generally not approve dayanim that they don't approve of. But the standards are the standards that we want, and they're the standards that the Beis Din of America have used for Ishur Legerus since 1994. We want RCA members to do conversions when the congregant is, in fact, Orthodox, and not any other time. That's been our standard for a long time, and we're now forming conversion courts that implement that standard.
Acceptance of the dayanim is subject to control by the rabbanut.
It's not an issue. Nobody's ever been rejected who we want. This is just like, you, if this bothers you.
And if you wanted a diameter of an insect.
It has not yet happened. The formal process is that Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Schechter can, through the three of them, approve any dayan. But in truth, we wouldn't put forward a dayan that another rabbinical organization that we respected thought was puzzle. For sure not. For sure not. And by the way, if we turn to the Rabbanut and said, you know, we think this dayan in the Rabbanut is puzzle, that would have an impact there. And by the way, if the rabbinate of France turned to us and said, this dayan, we think he's puzzle, not just inept, but puzzle, that would cause us a great deal of concern. Sure. My gosh, the assertion that a dayan is ineligible to sit, that should set off alarm bells. For sure. For sure. From a sister organization that we respect, there'd be good reason not to push that one through. I, on the contrary, I think that that's probably a good idea.
Just a question to extend that. How far along is the process in creating these regional based dayans?
I think that there are regional courts right now. As I get older, my memory starts to fail. So let's do it geographically. Boston, New York, Washington, Miami have regional Batei Din. Atlanta is in the process of forming one that covers the whole southeast from Dallas to Charleston down to Tampa. Chicago has a regional Beis Din. Los Angeles has a regional Beis Din. Seattle has a regional Beis Din. San Francisco does not and is right now being handled by Los Angeles. I think that that's it in the United States. So we're not quite in every place where there's a football team, but we're in most places. I mean, you know, you want to know why there isn't a regional Beis Din in Topeka, Kansas? So the answer is there aren't a lot of religious Jews in Topeka, Kansas. You want to know why there isn't a regional Beis Din in Philadelphia? If the answer is Philadelphia is governed by, governed is too strong a word, Philadelphia is covered by the integrated process of the New Jersey Regional Courts, which is run directly by the Beis Din of America. So there's no, it happens that Pennsylvania is an awkward state. Nothing personal, because Philadelphia is close enough to northern New Jersey, which is so insanely Jewish, that it's not worthwhile for Philadelphia to run its own Beis Din here. It's covered by what's called the Vada Rabbanim of Bergen County. So the answer is there's certainly a process in Philadelphia. I don't think there's a process in Pittsburgh, because even though Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are both in Pennsylvania, like Pittsburgh is, if you'll excuse me, Yenemsville. Meaning it's so far away that you can't run a United Pittsburgh-Philadelphia Beis Din because it's like a million miles away. And maybe I've left some out. They say as you get old, two things fail. I don't remember the first one, but memory's the second.
Hard to draw a line, and you said that drawing a line is arbitrary. So, my personal opinion is, are you saying that as long as we form groups and we support each other, then it's fine to what our group wants, because that's where we draw the line? And with respect to the idea of drawing lines, my son wanted to ask, how much water do you add to chicken soup before?
Right. So I don't know the answer to the second question. I think to the first question, you have to draw your own standards and you have to announce them and have transparency and let people who like your standards adhere to them and let people who don't like your standards form alternative groups with different standards. I make no claim of exclusive authenticity. I could well imagine a group to the left of us and I could well imagine a group to the right of us, and that would be fine.
Retroactively negating conversions from Orthodox, not only Orthodox rabbis, the rabbi who's Orthodox, from his own mitzvahs, an Orthodox congregation, is there a history of it actually happening before? That we're going back now 20-something years, 30 years, and saying, this rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, did a conversion, which we say now, since they were not Makabal Mitzvahs, is not good.
You're asking a practical question.
Yes.
In practice, it's exceptionally rare that a conversion done by an Orthodox rabbi in an Orthodox synagogue is ruled invalid. The great issue, which entails an element almost of consumer fraud, is Orthodox ordained rabbis in non-Orthodox shuls who are marketing themselves as Orthodox rabbis for these purposes, whose conversions we historically do not accept. So if you're a YU musmach in a conservative shul, so you might tell people you're yeshiva university trained, but there's an element of a lack of integrity in identifying yourself that way.
I'm not referring to those rabbis.
It's exceptionally rare that one has conversions done by Orthodox rabbis in Orthodox synagogues deemed invalid, although there have been a number of cases of fraud.
But my little experience I have is that it's happening now, based on the Saka Rabbi Shrein.
I think in America it's exceptionally rare.
I just saw it.
It could be.
And
the rabbis who are doing this, are they, well-established rabbis in Orthodox shuls?
Yes.
It could be.
But they're doing Geres Mechuma, which is very nice, except when the Geres Mechuma won't work. Or if someone wants to marry a Kohen, or one of the children,
okay,
of the marriage is no longer Shomer Torah mitzvahs.
Okay, I won't disagree. We'll see how it plays out. The breadth of Orthodoxy in the 50s was astonishingly broad, and it's resonated as a very complex situation because rabbis did things in the 50s that we no longer really understand the halachic standards that they employed.
And you don't think that local Batei Din in many cities are now afraid of what's going on in Israel, that they're overreacting and retroactively engaging kids?
I don't think so.
Okay, I'm sorry. I hate to do this, but we have no choice. Our next session is starting in about 3 to 4 minutes. Don't go.
Just first of all, I just want to make sure everybody has one of these, the upcoming, programs that are outside. I want to thank, Rabbi Broidus. A pleasure having him.